In our final session, we will be davening mincha upstairs. It's my pleasure at this point to reintroduce Dr. Herb Basser. At his first talk, he invoked Isaiah, "I am the first and I am the last," and he was the first presenter today. He will be in the cleanup position. Dr. Basser is a professor at Queen's University. Has specialized in the scholarly work in the general fields that we're discussing today. The early history of Judaism and Christianity, teaches New Testament texts at university, and has obviously spent a tremendous amount of his academic and personal time delving into the very, very issues that we're exploring here today, the interface of Christianity and Judaism. Again, my pleasure to reintroduce Dr. Herb Basser.
As a general reaction to certain terms that we've used today, I should point out that they're specifically Jewish. I don't know any Christians who would call Christianity a daughter religion of Judaism, and there is some historical justification for what they say. They would look at Christianity as a sister religion. They would claim there was an Israelite religion, there was it developed along certain paths, there were certain kinds of Judaisms, and that Christianity is heir to one of those different kinds of Judaisms, and Talmudic Judaism, the kind of Jews we are, is heir to a different strand in Judaism as a religion of the Bible, and we have come along parallel paths rather than some kind of path where we have had Judaism as an original religion and then Christianity somehow or other given birth by Judaism. So whichever view you're going to take, I just want to point out that the term daughter religion is a kind of a contentious one, and when we use it, Christians would see it as somewhat chauvinistic. Should also point out that when people engage in polemics and dialogues between certain faiths, and I have done this actually on both sides of the fence. At certain times I have been part of the Christian group because I work for a United Church Theological College, and at parts I have been on the other side of the line arguing as an Orthodox rabbi. I've been actually on both sides of the line working with the National Council of Christians and Jews. And the one thing that has always struck me in these discussions is it's very easy to find the warts on the other person. But in trying to point out their warts, you overlook your own. And so, therefore, a lot of debate and discussion is really besides the point. And I'm thankful that Professor Lowy today actually pointed out that there are also very positive things that have been said back and forth. It's one of the things that in polemics also, we always find our enemy group. When we want to castigate our own group, we always say, look at those other groups, how well they do. If Yaakov Emden wanted to criticize yeshivas, he said, look at the Sephardim, how they learn. We Ashkenazim can learn something from them. If Christians wanted to talk about, the man Pelicanus said, we Christians don't know our Bible well enough. I met a 13-year-old girl, and she knew Bible backwards and forwards, not only in Latin, but also in Hebrew. And so you always find the group that you think of the least, and you say, even they can do it. I remember a kind of drasha of the Baal Shem Tov, who was asked about egalitarianism in Judaism, men and women being equal, and he said, after all, Sarah and all these texts that are parade texts, God told Abraham, listen to Sarah, and Sarah knows better than you, etc., etc., so therefore we are very welcoming towards women's opinions, etc., in Judaism. So the Baal Shem Tov said, you know, if I go to a museum and I look at the pictures there, I always look at pictures of someone with a sword who slayed a dragon 10 times his size. Why is that picture there? It's because it's very rare and unique and it never happens. So therefore, the artist has to draw this picture. So if we find certain verses in the Bible highlighting something, it's probably a sign that the general tone of things is quite different and that this is a remarkable case. So when we have text and we quote back and forth, sometimes we have to realize that things are in the text because they're remarkable. I'm going to talk about some misconceptions, and I have a long list of things. But before I do that, I want to continue what I was talking about this morning. This morning I kind of talked about being cautious and a negative view. We really can't know too much about history. We can only know the intellectual history, what people were saying. We really can't know the real events. And I want to talk about more positive things today, not positive in the sense that they're beneficial, but at least things that we can talk about and we can look at and say, this is how a scholar would put it together. So I want to invite you into my workshop and show you how, in modern scholarship, we deal with Talmudic texts about Jesus and about some other things. Now, I left off this morning talking about a text, and actually Professor Lowy has this Maimonides text from the Book of Kings, chapter 11, where talking about how the Jews killed Jesus. And what's interesting in this Maimonides text, he is known as Yeshua, which is how the Christians refer to him. The Peshitta, the Syriac Aramaic text, refers to Jesus as Yeshua. And the Jews and the Talmud and the Midrashim always refer to him as Yeshu. And here we have the text, interestingly enough, if the text is believable here, that that Rabbi Lowy, that Dr. Lowy has given us, that he is referred to as Yeshua. Now, I never give handouts because people get more interested in the handouts than they do in me. And so, therefore, you just have to listen carefully. Listen to this text. I read it this morning. There's a problem in the text. All texts have problems in them. Listen to this text. See if you find the problem. On Passover Eve, they hung the body of Jesus. A herald had gone out for 40 days prior to it. He is to be stoned for sorcery and leading Israel astray. Anyone able to show his innocence should come and do so. No one was able to show him innocent, and he was hung on Passover Eve. So we start on Passover Eve. On Passover Eve, right, they hung the body of Jesus. The story ends, and he was hung on Passover Eve. Kind of a technical term for that called an inclusio. It's a sandwich, like me. It starts, you know, it starts the story and ends the story. But now we get another story in between. And a herald's gone out, and he cries out, he is to be stoned for sorcery and leading Israel astray. Now, what problem do we see right away? What's the problem? We're talking about stoning. And what does the story begin and end with? They hung him. So how did the stoning and the hanging get together? So the Talmud uses this, actually, not to talk about Jesus, but to show that there's a biblical verse that we can interpret to say that if somebody is a blasphemer, that first you stone the person, and then you hang the body of the person up, and then you take it off before nightfall. And therefore, there really isn't a contradiction. However, if we take a close look at the story, that's how the Talmud uses the story, we probably could conclude that there is some kind of problem with the hanging and the stoning. In fact, we could even ask the question, was he hung first and then stoned, or stoned and then hung? Anyone who studies Talmud will say, of course, he was stoned, and then his body was hung up for display. But I'm going to show you it's not the only way of understanding this text. So it seems to me, in fact, that we're going to find out that Christians also had this text as one of their proof texts that Jesus is the Messiah, and quotes a text that I'm going to spend some time on in Deuteronomy, talking about Jesus or the Messiah hanging on a tree. And therefore, even these Christian texts have Jesus hung. And it seems to me that the Jews kind of have picked up on a certain Christian tradition that is biblically based, and therefore this idea of hanging is not foreign to the account of Jesus as the Jews would know it. Now, what is this herald doing going out 40 days to find someone to excuse him? And then nobody can be found. Why is that part of the story there? What part of the story is that? When did we ever hear that you wanted to send out a messenger, and from the way the text sounds like Jesus is being paraded in the street, and there's a man screaming, anybody who knows, he's going to be hung, you know, stoned for source. Anybody who knows anything to save him, come forward, and then nobody comes forward. Where do we see any judicial process like that at all? So this, in fact, bothered the later Amoraim. This text that I'm talking about is a text about 180 or something like that. A couple of hundred years later, the Talmud starts saying, well, what is this story all about anyways? And then, in this story, they conclude that Jesus, the word they use is karov l'malchut, which has different interpretations. The most normal interpretation is he's a friend of the Romans, and therefore we just can't put him to death. We have to be very careful that we show that everybody agrees that he's guilty, and now we can put him to death. Seems to me that this part of the text, saying that the herald went out, whatever the herald says, is clearly put in at some point to show that Jesus was not innocent. Nobody ever thought he was innocent. And the Jews bent over backwards to do everything they could to help him, but nobody came forward, so what could they do? Later Amoraim claimed he was Karov Lamalhut, that they wouldn't have done this for Jesus. They would have stoned Jesus in 10 seconds. They would have hung him up in 10 seconds. But while he was a friend of the Romans, and therefore you didn't want to antagonize the Romans, so for 40 days they wanted to prove to the Romans that Jesus was in fact guilty, and that's really what this story is about. Someone suggests Karov Lamalhut cannot mean that he was friendly with the Romans. The Babylonian Amoraim had to know that in the time of Jesus, that Jesus was not a friend of the Romans. In fact, in the Gospels, he's crucified by the Romans. And so why are they calling him a friend of the Romans? It's true probably by this time that Christianity is part of the has made tremendous headways into the Roman Empire. It's probably the state religion of Rome. But nevertheless, how did the Jews think that? So Lauterbach, as I mentioned before, my kind of scholarly grandfather, the teacher of Silberman, who was my teacher, said, maybe Karov Lamalhut means he was related to the kingdom of David, King David. Maybe Karov Lamalhut means he was a relative of King David. He was descended through King David's line, and therefore people have to be very careful. Maybe he really, you know, shouldn't be put to death, and maybe some of the things he's saying could have some truth. I don't think that's you know, at all possible, but it's a way at least of saving the text and saying the Amoraim weren't as foolhardy as they appear to be by saying that Jesus was a friend of the Romans. At any rate, Christians themselves, as I mentioned, in a number of places in the New Testament, refer to the hanging of Jesus. And in this way, they were able to find reference to Jesus' death in the Tanakh, which talks about hanging a body on a tree. Let's begin with some Christian references. Galatians 3:13 uses the word chilon, which is an Aramaic word. Also, it's coming from the Greek, which means a tree. It doesn't mean a cross. So here's the text written by Paul. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God. Doing mitzvahs just isn't going to hack it. It is evident, for it says, the just shall live by his faith. Tzadik b'amunato yichya, Habakkuk 2:4. We will find a very interesting passage in the Talmud, of all places, the very last page of Tractate Makot, page 24, that says, yes, Moses gave 613 laws, and then a whole series of prophets came, kept reducing them, until we got to Habakkuk, who said the final statement of Judaism, not Christianity, is Tzadik b'emunato yichyeh. It's a very strange text, and we would expect that to appear somewhere in the name of a Christian author. We have it as the concluding page of a tractate of the Talmud. I don't want to say more than that, but some of these things are interesting, and in some ways, the Christian critique of Judaism is sometimes worth listening to, especially when it comes to paying sometimes more attention to certain details of traditions rather than getting to the heart of the matter itself. One of the things that I always like is that on Rosh Hashanah, people don't eat nuts. Why don't people eat nuts on Rosh Hashanah? If you add up the letters, it almost comes out to the same letters as sin, as chet. But while I know a lot of people who are very careful not to eat nuts on Rosh Hashanah, I don't know very many people who are that careful not sinning. You know, the symbol of it, the tradition of it, the not eating of the nuts is okay. But I always tell them, you know, chet in gematria is also chet. You know, a sin, the letters of sin also add up to sin. So maybe we should be careful about that. At any rate, that is one of the critiques of sometimes it's worthwhile listening to what others have to say about you. Okay, he says, the law is not of faith. When you keep the Torah, it's nothing to do with faith. But the man that doeth them shall live in them. V'chai behem, we all know that text, Leviticus 18:5. Paul is saying, live by faith compared with live by law. So they're different. If we have a verse in the Torah says that you live by faith, and then it says that the man that doeth them shall live in them, then there's two types of living that are compared. Live by faith compared with live by the law. They're different. The tzaddik, the word tzaddik, is not mentioned with the law. So that does not vindicate or justify a person. The law is good. A person can live by them, should live by them, but it doesn't bring you ultimate redemption. The word tzaddik in Paul, the hot state, is justification by faith. To justify yourself, that takes faith. And that was actually the Hasidic critique of Mishnagdin. They didn't have enough faith. They lived by the law, but the simple faith of the simple shoemaker or carpenter was worth the learning of great rabbis who didn't have the simple faith of the little person. And therefore, these texts are sometimes really interesting to track through Jewish history. And at some point, I do want to point out that Christianity is on the same track as Kabbalistic groups and mystical groups and Hasidic groups in some kind of continuation. Okay, now Paul continues. What happens if you don't keep the law? What happens if you just have faith and you don't keep the law? So then Paul continues, the Torah says, cursed is everyone who does not keep the law. You're going to be cursed. So in Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 26, and Paul continues, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. How did he redeem us from the curse of the law? Being made a curse for us. For it is written in Deuteronomy 21:22, and this is his translation of it, "Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree," and he uses the word chilon here, which is not a cross, stauron, as I mentioned this morning, but it's a kind of tree that Jews did use to hang corpses on. In other words, he suffered the penalty of curse without cause, so he can save others who were cursed with cause. People who broke the law and were cursed, Jesus has suffered their curses, and therefore that curse will not bother people anymore. Jesus has redeemed them. And it's interesting, I'll get to a point later where, time permitting, I will talk about mitat tzadikim, a Jewish concept that the death of the righteous, since they don't have anything to suffer for, why do they suffer? It is who's okay. It is mechaper. It is it brings atonement, and biblical verses are used for that for people who do have sins and for the generation that what we call vicarious atonement. Is also a motif in Judaism, although it's denied now. After the fact of Christianity, we readjust our text to give them new interpretations, and maybe if we do have time, I'll tell you some of these new interpretations of these texts so that we don't end up sounding too Christian. But in fact, this kind of idea of vicarious atonement that Paul adduces from the text is quite clever. My point in saying all of this is just to bring a biblical text and to point out that the Greek word chulon or eitz is mentioned, and not a cross or a stauron. We read now in the book of Peter, I call him Pseudo-Peter, because I don't think it was really written by Peter, and it's 1 Peter 2:24, who is talking about Jesus, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, again, chulon. If you hear me mixing up chulon and chulon, it's just because the Litvaks say chulon, and the Hasidim like to say chulon, so I'm always confused whether I'm going to talk Litzianer or whether I'm going to be a Litvak. So my pronunciation of Greek switches back and forth. Okay, now he says, "We being dead to sins should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes ye were healed." And we get to Acts 5:20, and the text here says, very strange, "who you slew and hung," in our current translations. It's not what the Greek says. Uses the word slew, hung, together. Slew by hanging, I don't know. The Harvard Classics of 1909 to 1914 has a good translation here. "We must obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom ye slew, hanging him on a tree." So again, it sounds like our text in Sanhedrin, first you stoned him, then you hung him on a tree, or maybe, since it doesn't say "and," or you slew by hanging him on a tree, maybe there was only hanging, or maybe he was hung on the tree and then stoned. We don't know. "You stiff-necked people with uncircumcised hearts and ears, you are just like your fathers. You always resist the Holy Spirit. Was there ever a prophet your fathers did not persecute? They even killed those who predicted the coming of the Righteous One, and now you have betrayed and murdered him." What does it mean, murdered him? Murdered Jesus. You Jews murdered him. Doesn't say the Romans did, as they killed Stephen. That's where this passage occurs. No Roman intermediary. How possible is it that Christians assigning meaning to Jesus' death based on Deuteronomy 21:22, that these texts were somehow known to Jews, and that our text that talks about or is confused about whether he is stoned or whether he is hung or hung and stoned or stoned and hung, there's probably two separate stories that are somehow glued together, and so the text doesn't exactly hang together. That's how we work. We look for discrepancies within a story and we try to say, this is source A and this is source B, and we apply it to Talmudic texts, And in this way, somebody pointed out to me a couple of minutes ago that if Lauterbach was my grandfather, then my great-grandfather was Wellhausen. And in fact, that is correct. What Lauterbach did by studying with Wellhausen was took all his critical theories of how to read text. He couldn't apply them to Tanakh because he worked in Hebrew Union College, and Rabbi Wise of Hebrew Union College did not like biblical criticism, did not like Wellhausen, and therefore Lauterbach took all his methodology and applied it quite brilliantly, was really the first one to do what we call source criticism of the Talmud. So the Jewish story isn't just taken over by Jews. It becomes an answer to the Christian claim. Yeah, we did hang Jesus, but you know why? Not to give you redemption. It had nothing to do with redemption. He was a sorcerer. He was a magician. He was a blasphemer. All those things that you know in your New Testament that you complained we were saying about him, it's true. We gave him 40 days to show that it wasn't true. But what do you want? It was true. So he was put to death because he was guilty, and therefore his death cannot atone. A death can only atone if you're a tzaddik, if you're innocent. But he wasn't innocent, so therefore his death has no atonement quality. Now, okay. Let me skip ahead to one more text, which I think is probably the most interesting text of all our texts here. And it's a text that's found in a number of places. Sanhedrin 107b is the most famous place for it. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, La'olam tehei smal docha, your left hand should push away, the amin mekarevet, your right hand should be welcoming, like a traffic light. Okay? Velo kalisha shadach dechafo legeichazi b'shte yadayim, velo ki Yehoshua ben Prachya shadachafo leyeshu b'shte yadayim. And the point is, not like Yehoshua ben Prachya, who pushed away Jesus with two hands. Now, I have to think this is a really good story. Because I also think if we flip this around, and this will be my most controversial statement of the day, that in a certain sense, Christians have allowed Judaism to survive, whereas Professor Novak said, had we gone to India, we would have gotten slaughtered. But Christians allowed Judaism to survive, and it was actually Augustine's theory that you have to do two things. You have to push them away with the left, but you can't kill them. You have to point out they're in error, this and that, and you have to bring them closer to Christianity or closer to full with your right. You can't push them away with both hands. Here we get the story the other way around, saying that that's what happened to Jesus. Jesus was pushed away by Yehoshua ben Prachya. Now, what's problematic here is we point out Yehoshua ben Prachya lives 130 years or something before Jesus, but that's neither here nor there. When Rabbi Yochanan is always has very strange statements, claims he went sat on the tomb of Ben Sora or Morris, somebody who was stoned for not listening to his father. He also claims he went into Anir Nidacha, the city. What's that? Oh, Yonason. Okay. But anyways, we get your strange stories. You have to check the manuscripts on that, by the way. Okay. We get here about a story about Yehoshua ben Prachya and Jesus going on a trip, and they're going to Egypt. They stop off at an inn, and here Jesus notices the innkeeper, a woman of great beauty, and offers a mark to the rabbi. Then he pushed her away, the rabbi pushed away Jesus and said, I don't want to have anything to do with you. You were thought I was talking about how beautiful the innkeeper was. I was really talking about how nice the hotel was. And it said that Jesus set up a levinta. The word is zakaf, could also mean to hang a brick or a plaque. And it's intimated that he worshipped it. And he is said now to have worked magic, and that he led people astray and brought them to the worship of idols, etc., etc. This is a much later addition to the story, centuries later, trying to explain why we're talking about Yoshua ben Prachya pushing away Jesus and what the circumstances were. Now, Lauterbach makes a convincing case here that this story probably is not about Yoshua ben Prachya, probably not about Jesus, but became convenient to plug these names in here since we don't know who the story was about. We have another story, and this is a story, in fact, about a man called Yehuda ben Tabai. He lives around the same time as Yeshua ben Prachya. That's Ben Stada. That's a different story than this. This is just a statement. Tanu Rabbanan, Yolam Teisma Dochev, Yamin Mekarevet. The story, you mean the Amoraic story plugs in some of the aspects of going to Egypt to copy some magic which seems to be influenced by this this earlier story, but that's not my point here. My point here is simply that Lauterbach claims that this story we have another version of this story, word for word almost, with Yehuda ben Tabai. And it's in the Yerushalmi Chagiga 2:2. It's very similar. It doesn't mention Jesus, just some wayward student. And it looks like that it was a background story, and then we wanted to bring Jesus into the picture here. Okay, so we have a curse against Christians mentioned in texts that we found in the Shmona Esrei. Today we say Al HaMalshinim, right? We have texts against a thing called Birkat HaMinim, although we don't mention Minim in it per se, against heretics. We have a prayer that is for the downfall of heretics. Oh, it is there in the Nusach Sfarad. Okay. Hanotzrim is mentioned in the Nusach Sfarad, or just Haminim? Oh, okay, yeah. But in the text that we find in the Geniza, we actually have the text of Notzrim, and I've written considerably about the history of that text. And Rashi, in his commentary to the Bible and the uncensored versions, points out that the Minim, in fact, are the followers of Jesus. So we have very strong language, and this curse is mentioned by the Church Fathers. We have a lot of tensions in the break between Judaism and Christianity. Today, Jews in many places face hatred and violence. We cannot stoop to the ideas of the past to give us comfort, for then we have no moral ground from which to seek justice. We must not propagate our own hatreds, but find that which makes us unique and celebrate that. Now, in looking at the history of Judaism and Christianity, it might come as news to a lot of people that, in fact, Newton was a great Talmudist. It's estimated that he was the third greatest Talmudist in England. He knew more than just about all the other rabbis in 17th century England. A lot of his writings and his books have been preserved. And he knew them in the original. It should, if people want to do some more research on this, there have been some articles written, and his notes are, Newton's notes are in a library. And Newton was castigated by his own bishop for paying attention to the Talmudic texts. Newton himself was a deeply religious Christian, but he never went to church. So there's some interesting things to talk about there. Now, to the topic of mistakes and misconceptions. The death of the righteous atones for all. Vicarious atonement. I've already mentioned that we have Jewish sources for this. In the midst of Leviticus, God addresses Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, who died when they drew too close to the presence of the Eternal. I'm quoting from a text here. The Jerusalem Talmud asks, why does the Torah mention their death in discussing the observances of Yom Kippur? To teach you that just as Yom Kippur atones for the Jewish people, so does the death of the righteous atone for the Jewish people. Rabbi Baruch HaLevi Epstein observes about this teaching, it is not the death itself that atones. It is the aftermath of that loss, how a righteous person is mourned and respected, which affects atonement for the Jewish people. Notice how he is mitigating the force of vicarious atonement. That whereas Christians believe in vicarious atonement, obviously we can't take this literally. Jews can't believe the same thing, and now we start to find excuses that the text really doesn't mean what the text says. If we take a look at Moed Katan 28a, we'll see the same thing about the Parah Aduma. Why is the Parah Aduma this red heifer that brings atonement? Why is that episode brought in connection with the death of Miriam? To tell you, just as a righteous person, just as the red heifer atones, so does the death of a righteous person atone. The point is that Jesus was the tzaddik who died to bear the sins of everyone who had sinned and would sin for all time. That is the polemic. But in point of fact, Christianity had a problem. And that problem was, as has been mentioned, that if you have the death of, we see it in Shabtai Tzvi too, when you have the death of a Messiah and everybody's expecting great things to happen, and that Messiah dies, you now have a theological problem. You have to explain it away somehow. The theology actually comes second to the fact. It's a theological victory for the failure of history. So, therefore, now to attract Gentiles into the church, you say Jesus, in fact, died for the sins, and you start to bring proof text after proof text after proof text. It's true that in the Jewish accounts, it's one person can atone for a whole generation, etc., etc., and maybe not for everybody, but... Right. So he said, between me and my son, we could atone for everything. I've written on that. But I don't know that he said that, and that's another Talmudic story. It's a whole other thing that we won't get into. No, I don't know that anybody said anything. Yeah, that's what I said this morning. All that I know is that if we have the writings of Paul, we have letters of Paul. When I write a quote from Galatians, I know Paul said that. If you have a letter from... from Shimon Bar Yochai, I'm happy to accept it. We won't get into the dating of Paul's letters and the historical evidence, but at any rate, just say that is the theology that has been propagated in Paul's name, if that makes you more comfortable. It doesn't make any difference to me whether Paul said it or somebody else, some other time called Paul also said it. Did it? Okay. Right. Okay. Now, when the Zaken sits and expounds, here's another text, Midrash Shmuel, when the Zaken sits and expounds, that the death of the righteous are atonement for Israel in every place where they live. At that time, your consolations delighted my soul. Psalm 94:19. So that when anybody gives this drasha, the death, the righteous don't even have to die. Somebody just has to give the drasha that they're dead, and therefore your soul will get a lot of nachas from that. In Midrash Tehillim 15, the death of martyrs is more important than sacrifices. We talk about that there are three kinds of people who are tortured. One part is the generation of the avot and onwards, that one for the generation of Shmad, that their atonement is more valuable than sacrifices. And then we mention Bar Kokhba, and we even mention in certain texts that the torture of King Messiah is mentioned, and the text is brought in Midrash Shmuel, where Isaiah 53 is cited, a famous Christian text, he suffered for our sins. Who is served by all of these texts? Well, that is always the question when one reads religious texts. Who is best served by the text? And if we read the Christian texts, obviously the Christians are better served. If we read the Jewish texts, obviously the Jews are better served. And therefore, for the historian of texts, these become all texts become suspect on that light, in terms of their historicity, but in terms of what people believed and what people thought and what people engaged in, these traditions are extraordinarily important. If we take a look at some things that we think are purely Christian, faith healing. Jesus said to faith heal, people have said this is a Christian thing, people faith heal in the name of Jesus. Faith healing is not particularly a Christian idea that we can find to this very day, that you will go and you'll give a Rebbe a little note or some money or something like that, and the Rebbe will make a prayer because his faith is stronger than yours, and prayers can be answered and people can be saved. And maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. I don't know what the what counts as evidence here or not, but I'm just trying to say that this is perhaps a Christian idea. We've all seen Oral Roberts and whatever in the great tents. But these ideas, again, are not all that foreign to Judaism. I should point out also that the criticism of the Pharisees that's mentioned by Christians also has counterparts in certain Jewish texts. Talks about seven types of Pharisees. Some of them are not too decent people as well. We're told that King Alexander Yanai said to his wife when he was dying, "Do not be afraid of the Pharisees or the non-Pharisees, but for the wildcats who mimic the Pharisees, who pretend to be Pharisees, they're very dangerous people. Their deeds are like the deeds of Zimri, but they seek the reward of Pinchas." Okay. If we take a look at what Josephus has to say about Pharisees, he says the Pharisees love one another and practice consensus in their community, but the Sadducees behave rather aggressively even towards each other, and they are as harsh in debates among themselves as with others. Interestingly enough, Steve Mason has written a number of books, and it's generally accepted now, that while Josephus says this about Pharisees, he has nothing else in his histories when it comes to talking about the Pharisees. He does not have a good word to say about Pharisees at all. It becomes extremely interesting. Christianity puts a lot of emphasis on grace, that God decides who God's going to be kind to, and doesn't matter whether you're good or bad or whatever, somehow or other, God can extend grace to you. And it's based in a verse in Exodus 33:18, and he said, "Show me, I pray thee, thy glory." And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious." Christian view now of Romans 9:13, also considered one of the authentic letters of Paul. And Paul mentions, it's written in the Bible, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? How can God say it? He loves Jacob and he hates Esau. What kind of decency is that in God? God forbid. For he said to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I shall have compassion. Therefore then, it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. What does it all depend on? Depends on God showing you mercy. It doesn't depend on what you're gonna claim, and God has his own reasons for showing mercy to the people he shows mercy to, and you can't complain. You have to accept that whatever God has given you, God is giving you for a purpose, because God ultimately has compassion, God ultimately has grace. Now, the great debate between Christians and Jews is between justice and mercy, sometimes phrased as justice and love. Remember reading at the back of a book called The Sunflower that Dennis Prager has an essay on how Jews, there was a radio program where a girl was raped, and the priest said we should love the rapist and feel sorry for him, and the Jews said no, we shouldn't, and he had a whole debate between a Christian and a Jew on this, and all the Jews agreed with the Jew, and the Christians agreed with the Christian of the idea of justice versus love. And exactly how that plays out is extremely interesting in terms of Middle Eastern politics, where a British judge came when the state was founded and there were differences between Muslims and Jews, and the British judge got everybody together and said, gentlemen, let's all be Christians. Like in Ireland, right. The other differentiation between Jews and Christians often is brought that law versus faith, law versus gospel, that Jesus came to teach love, and that Jews abide by the law, and therefore Jesus is to Christianity what Torah is to Judaism, and there is that kind of equality that is set up. I myself am suspicious of that kind of equation. Certainly Paul, in his letters, real or otherwise, makes the distinction somehow that when Jesus died, he died to the law, the law died with him, and the law is no longer efficacious. There are other interpretations of Paul to say that Christianity has been grafted onto the Jewish covenant somehow, and that Jewish law still is meaningful, but now there is hope for the Gentiles as well. Be that as it may, the text that I quoted before from the Talmud of Makot, that began saying Moses commanded 613 commandments, and Habakkuk reduced all of them to the righteous man shall live by his faith, is an intriguing teaching, which brings us to consider that really texts are just texts, and the people who read the texts read them in light of their upbringing. They see in them what they want to see in them. They find in them what they want to find in them. No Jewish rabbi is going to admit that this is a Christian message. No Christian is going to admit in passages of the Talmud that there is a Jewish, I'm sorry, in the Bible, that there is a Jewish message there. I wrote an entire book. I think Rabbi Skobach probably has read it by now. I don't know. I don't even see him. But I'm trying to... Oh, he is here. Okay. Did you get a chance to look at my book yet? You did. Okay. The entire first part of the book is to prove that Jesus was a Talmid Chacham. I don't know if he's a Pharisee or not, I don't know, but he's a Talmid Chacham. He could argue halacha as well, or even better than anybody. And that if you really understand what the texts are saying, then you'll understand that Jesus has a valid point within what we would consider rabbinic halacha for all his interpretations. Well, it's not that I want to say that I'm right or I'm wrong, but it's just that I want to tell you, the Christians rejected me, the Christian reviews, I didn't get any good reviews, I'll tell you what. The Christians who read my book say it's impossible, you overlooked this, that, the other. The Jews said, what are you talking about? how can you say that when you're talking? So it seems that I get crushed from both sides when I want to talk about, mistakes and mistaken notions. In the last 2 minutes, just want to mention that Jews also have a dying Messiah. He's known as Menashe ben Ephraim. He's mentioned in numbers of places. We call him Messiah ben Joseph, that he is a warlike Messiah and a kind of a Bar Kokhba figure. And exactly the history of development of this idea, I don't have time to go into. But that Jews also have two Messiahs, a dying Messiah and a Messiah, the son of David. Normally, we tend to think that the Jewish Messiah is national and political, that our Messiah is going to redeem us, he's going to create a state of Israel in which everybody's going to be religious and we'll have all the territories, and even more than all the territories, we're going to our borders are going to extend right to the Euphrates, and we're going to be at the Nile, and we're going to at any rate, we see ourselves national and political. We won't be subjugated by the nations anymore. That's our Messiah. The Christian Messiah is a different kind of Messiah. It's spiritual. It is redemptive. It's atonement. It's at a deeper personal level. The Christians often say that Jews or Pharisees add the burdens of ritual law, but they don't lift a finger for moral law. That's something to think about, that in ritual laws we have all kinds of chumras. We want to be very, very exact. When we come to moral law, we don't have the same protective fences when it comes to moral law. We have a concept of repairing the world. Jews, at least in the mystical concept of Judaism, have a concept of repairing the world. And in a sense, where does this idea come from? Tikkun Olam, this whole idea that we're supposed to be, our acts could actually lead to bettering the world. It's a mystical idea. And in fact, if we take a look at early strands of Judaism, earlier than Christianity, we will find that there are different types of Judaism. There's a Judaism that's identified with Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria also is a kind of trinity where you have a logos, you have a kind of divine name, and you have powers of justice and mercy accompanying this divine name of God, this divine power, that there's a kind of trinity set up, and there's a spiritual mechanism to the world. Turns out to be a little bit like Plato's in mechanisms when you read Philo, but at any rate there is a whole mystical concept. This mystical concept we can find in the works in the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran. We can find this same strand in other works of the first century. We can find in the New Testament itself, we have books like the Book of Hebrews, books like Revelation, books like the prologue to the Book of John, that has a deeply spiritual type of way of looking at things in a kind of mystical universe. And we can locate another kind of Judaism in which Christianity and its atonement motifs is heir to that, and that mystical Judaism in underground currents for a certain amount of time, but then later more fully, is also here. We also have it in Judaism. So there could be an argument made that Christianity is a kind of form of Judaism that Jews kind of rejected en masse at a certain point. Someone asked me before if I would just say a few words about Edom and Ishmael, and I just want to end on this note. It's usually taken for granted that Christians are that Rome is somehow genetically connected to Edom, to the line of Esau, and that Arabs and Muslims are connected to the line of Ishmael. If we take a look at verse 27:40, Ibn Ezra does not accept that. He says, "Those who are intellectually asleep, not having been awakened from their idle slumber, think that we are an exile of Edom. This is not true. The real Edom was certainly under the power of Judea, and so Scripture states, and Edom revolted from under the power of Judah. Also in the days of Agrippa, when Jerusalem was besieged, regiments of Edomites came to help Judea." So the Edomites were friends of the Judeans. They weren't the enemies. When they were fighting the Romans, they were the friends. So they couldn't be the Romans. "Actually, the Roman nation which sent us into exile is descended from the Kittim." And he goes on and tries to bring different proof texts. And he said, "There were just a few people who eventually undertook the new faith, which held that a man had made himself a god. And as they preserved their religion until the days of Constantine, who renewed the whole religion and put on his flag the image of that man," I don't know where he got that from, "and before that time there was no one in the world who accepted the new religion except for a few Edomites." That's Ibn Ezra. Where he got his information from, I've no idea. But he wants to kind of say that, you know, the very first Christians were Edomites. But later on, when Rome took over, Christianity was no longer, you know, Edom is not Rome, and it's somebody else altogether. But since the first couple of Christians were Edomites, we call Christianity Edom. And he says, "Similarly today, people are called Egyptians, and they call Egyptians, Sabians, and Elamites Ishmaelites, even though there is not one amongst them from the descendants of Ishmael, except for a very small number." And in conclusion, I'd just like to sum up and say you've had a very, very full day of different kinds of talks. It's very difficult to sit through. I give people a lot of credit for sitting through this. I don't know precisely what your motivations are and your interests. It's kind of mind-boggling. I've been looking this way. I look this way. I see, you know, we also have people here to the right, to the left, in center, and that's really what a good Jewish community is, to my mind, that you have people to the right, to the left. You notice all day I've been speaking to the left, but that's my problem. There are nice people in the center here, and in fact, we always need more people in the center. So I'd like to kind of, again, thank all the people who put this together, and I'd like to thank all the speakers. And you've just been bombarded with so much information that I don't know how you're going to sort it out, but I understand that tapes have been made of all the presentations, and that's what I think that you should do, is buy the tapes. Thank you very much. Oh, and any questions? Are we going to have some questions? We can have some questions.
Okay, we'll be going in a few moments to Mincha. If I could just thank again all of our speakers, all of the people that volunteered today. If you're interested again in the interface of Christianity and Judaism, on the table there are schedules for upcoming Jews for Judaism seminars. We have our six-week seminar beginning January 14th on Wednesday evenings. And again, thank you all very much for your attendance today. Hope to see you all again in future programs.
We can dive in mincha in about 5 minutes upstairs.
Okay, my pleasure. Oh, okay. Usher, always a pleasure. I was nice to you. I just said usually to Dr. Ezra and Jerry, but the magic effects are always good stuff. Take a look at it. But he puts it in the road.
That's one text, that's the Shabbos.
Right.
There also is a text that he does magic. He went to Egypt and he came back. What you have a Yashka story, he went to Egypt and came back?
But that's also with Yashka Ben Prachia?
Yes.
That I don't have.
Oh, look it up.
You'll find it.
I'm being nice to you.
Okay.
The reason why we are not telling the Christians and the Arabs that they are not the Roman Empire.
No, there's no point to it. They claim we're not Yaakov either. In Israel, they say we are European Cruzolines or something like that.
That's the same point. We are continually validating their claim.
No, they don't claim to be Ishmael.
No, the Arabs claim to be Ishmael.
They claim to be Ishmael. But
why do we not repeat that argument?
Yes. Why should we? What's the point? People say that we're Yitzchak. They say, oh,
because they could not have any validity to say that they were cheated.
Yes.
If they're not
exactly.
The descendants of Israel, they have no claim.
Exactly. That's not their claim to the land.